Welcome to the Spanish Arpada. I'm Sarah.
And I am Peter.
And we are ranking and reviewing all of the rulers of Spain, from Leovigild to Felipe VI. But this time, we are going to do a little recap as to what we've been doing in this podcast for the past, couple months.
Forever.
So we've released two episodes recently, but those were actually recorded way back in the fall, and we took quite the hiatus.
We did.
And now we are back. I'm trying to get back on a regular recording and posting schedule. Before we do that, I kind of thought we'd just talk a little bit about what the heck is going on in Spain right now and do a little summary.
I think that's a good idea because it's been a minute and I'm unfamiliar with the players, although I can get it back with a little bit of effort.
Yes. Well, of course it's a good idea. It was your idea.
Well, there you go.
Right. So the first group of rulers we had in Spain were the Visigoths. They lasted until 711.
Yes.
And then at that point, we had the situation that we still have now that we're talking about in our podcast, which is we had a southern kingdom and then we have a northern kingdom. So the southern kingdom is the group who caused the Visigoths to fall. And that is Al-Andalus, the Muslims or the Caliphate, who for a little bit after 711 had a series of governorships of people who were subordinate to the caliph in Damascus.
Right.
And then the caliphate fell and a new dynasty began. Well, actually not in Damascus. They moved it to Baghdad. Then, as a result of that, we had Al-Andalus becoming an independent emirate.
All of these separate kingdoms on the outskirts basically said, you know, central government is not all it's cracked up to be, and we prefer to, you know, keep our own lawn tidy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we talked a lot in our very first emirs episode, which was Abd al-Rahman I.
Right. Yes.
We talked a little bit about the balancing act that a lot of the North African territories had to do specifically, where they didn't want to explicitly say, yeah, we're doing our own thing, but they also didn't want really to be part of the caliphate anymore either.
Right.
Yeah. So Abd al-Rahman I in 756, he was the boy who lived.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, so he was the
river crossings, and basically it's the Moses story told from a slightly different perspective.
Yes, the supposedly only surviving member of the Umayyad dynasty, which is not true, because then the sources go on to talk about several of his cousins and whatnot. So clearly he's not the only one. But he escaped certain death, made his way to Spain, and started the conquest of the governorship, basically kicked out the governor and said, you know what? I'm setting up a kingdom. Yeah. I'm not paying allegiance to those people in Baghdad now. They killed my entire family.
I was going to say, given the recent experiences with them, you know, I don't think we can do business.
No, but the interesting thing is he didn't set himself up to be a rival to the caliphate, right? No, he said that this is it's a kingdom. He's an emir, but he's not like his own caliph. So he didn't explicitly say, same thing with the North African territories, really. He didn't explicitly say, okay, I'm cutting you off, but he behaved as such.
Right, right. I mean, you don't want to be noisy about, if you can do an Irish goodbye, we're recording this on St. Patrick's Day, that's precisely what you want to do. You want to leave quietly because you're more likely to get out with any fuss. And that was shrewd. And that's why he is Abd al-Rahman I.
Yes. And between 758 and 788, he took power from all of the warring factions of Muslim rule that had been in Al-Andalus at the time.
Right.
And started building the Great Mosque in Cordoba.
Yay,
mosques. And just really set the tone for what the emirate was going to be.
Yes.
He was followed by his son, Hisham, who ruled not quite as long, but remember, he was the really pious, really dedicated guy.
Right.
Wouldn't cross a bridge because someone said, oh, you just built that bridge so you can get to your hunting grounds easier. And Hisham
scored
said, nope.
Very high in a certain category.
Yes, he did. And not very high on No Me Digas, I do tell you that.
No, right. An
extremely unscandalous
good man, and thus no fun to talk about.
But it's pretty good for Al-Andalus because it just cemented the legacy that Abd al-Rahman I, you know, started.
It's hard to sell the idea that these are, you know, anti-Muslim, irreligious rebels when, you know, the first two guys are building mosques and refusing to use bridges because, you know, it sends the wrong message. Like, yeah, these are goody two shoes. I'm sorry. They're on the right side. Sorry.
They're definitely goody two shoes. The next two emirs that we had, though, were not exactly goody two shoes because it was Al-Hakam the first and Abdalrahman the second. And both of them were super into the ladies.
Yes, they were.
Huge harems, huge courts, all kinds of, you know, decadence going on.
Right.
Once again, this served to build Cordova into the powerhouse where the court was, even
studied
further.
The history of the early Roman emperors and said, we can do this. This looks good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Al-Hakam had like, I think the sources said he had 75 children and then Abdalrahman had like 125 or something ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, guys. It's not a contest. Please don't do this anymore.
Well, yes. And then the last king, the last emir of Cordoba that we discussed was Muhammad the First.
Yes.
And this is where things kind of get a little interesting when it comes to the relations between Cordoba and the northern kingdom of Asturias, which we are going to talk about next. So when things, I've mentioned this several times on the podcast, when things go really well in Al-Andalus, things don't go so well in the north.
Yes, exactly.
So when you have these powerhouses like Abdalrahman, like Hisham, for example, the south is doing well and the north is not doing so well.
God basically looked at the Iberian Peninsula and said, I will give you this much good karma. And y'all
split it up amongst yourselves.
Yeah, basically split it up amongst yourselves. And they decided, trade-off? Yeah, sounds good. Trade-off.
So you can kind of see this difference in how good the kingdoms are doing when they participate in what I think you first called intramural sports warfare.
Yes, exactly.
Every campaign season, they go up against each other. Not really much is gained or lost. There's no necessarily expansion or contraction of territory.
You can always tell who wins because they get mentioned in the chronicles of that side.
Yes. And if they didn't win, gone.
What?
Didn't happen.
No, we sat out that season. We didn't play.
Exactly. We didn't play. We clearly didn't lose. Right. At the end of Abdalrahman's term, which was 822 to 852, and through Muhammad's kingship, which was 852 to 886, we saw a much more direct involvement of the two kingdoms in each other's business. Because what we had going on in Cordoba at that time was the whole issue with the martyrdom movement.
Right. Religious controversy is now... Well, we've seen in Muhammad I the rise of the first oppression of religious minorities under the emir.
We hadn't had
that before. I mean, the Visigoths loved to do that. They loved
oppressing the Jews. Yeah, I don't think they'd never even heard of a Muslim. They didn't much like pagans. So, if they had, they wouldn't have liked them.
Right.
Well, they learned really quickly, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I would say it's hold my beer, but being Muslims.
Right. So because of the increased, shall we say, fervor of the Christians in Al-Andalus, in addition to the difficulties that people who had converted from Christianity to Islam, the Muwallads. The difficulties that they had in rising in society to the level that they thought they were entitled.
Sure. We're literally supposed to be equal under the eyes of the book.
And, but in real life, it didn't work out that way. And people got real upset about that. So this is when we had the martyrdom movement where Christians would come up to the closest judge and be like, I'm a Christian and I believe Muhammad is a false prophet. And then, of course, they would get thrown in jail and executed.
Well, you're really not leaving me much choice here, says the
imam. No, not at all.
I was just having lunch and okay.
And then we also had a lot of rebellions, mostly led by Muwallads, the two most important ones in Toledo and in Mérida. And this was during
Neither
Muhammad's
of which ended
reign.
Well.
No, not for the Muwallads. But mm-hmm. the interesting thing about the uprising in Toledo, which was put down by Muhammad I,
yes.
is that it was in part supported by the king of Asturias, the king
That's
in the
right.
north at the time.
Monkey paw.
Yeah, so this is the first time we've seen a direct conflict between the two kingdoms that wasn't mm-hmm. just, oh, let's go fight each other because it's campaign season.
Right.
Yes. So this will be an interesting development to follow. Speaking of Asturias, let's yes. talk about what they were doing up there.
Okay.
So they didn't quite get started right at the same time as Al-Andalus. The governors went on for a little bit, and it was basically just, I don't want to say chaos, but unorganized in the north.
Yeah, they're still in the north eating honey.
Yes, so Pelagius, yes. our very first king, that was the story, right? Him and his rebels right. were hiding in a cave and eating honey to survive so that they could fight against the cruel Muslims that had taken mm-hmm. over their territory and blah, blah, blah. All of this yes. is a huge retcon.
Yes, of course. This is all a lie.
I wouldn't necessarily call it a lie. I would just call it an interesting story to support the fact that the kingdom of Asturias needed a reason to exist.
We are one step away from this guy pulling a sword from a stone. I'm not going to call it a lie exactly, but I am going to call it a retcon.
Let's call it a myth. I think that kind of encapsulates what kind of story this is.
Yes. All right. Fair.
Right. So Pelagius, there have been lots of attempts to tie him to the Visigothic nobility so that there's this right. continuity in Christian right. rule on the peninsula, which are probably all fake. Not going to lie. Another charming myth.
Yes.
But he takes power. He kind of coalesces the power around himself. And he has two children. His son, Favila, inherits mm-hmm. from him. And his daughter, who I think her name was Hermosinda, she gets married to a guy named Alfonso, who is the leader of a ruling family nearby.
Right.
Unfortunately, Favila gets eaten by a bear.
Yeah, he does.
After just 2 years of rule.
Leading to the most hilarious tapestry ever.
Yes. Poor guy. All of his miniatures were hilarious. But I feel bad for him.
Well,
that's all we remember him for.
If we're going to capture one image of you, we're going to capture the most interesting thing about you. And I hate to say this, but this isn't even close.
Yeah, it was definitely the bear. Mm-hmm. Definitely the bear. But that meant that when it came to inheriting Pelayo's territory, we had to go to his son-in-law, which is Alfonso,
right? Correct.
The guy who married Pelayo's daughter.
Yes.
Right? So this is Alfonso the First. He ruled until about 757. So he was mm-hmm. on the scene when Abd al-Rahman the First shows right. up. And Alfonso the First actually did most of the work of building the kingdom of Asturias, taking it right. from that mythical eating honey out of rocks point
right.
to a place with a court and a system of government and
right.
things of that nature.
Right. We now have zip codes and traffic lights.
Now, probably the most negative thing about Alfonso I is how many family members he had.
So many. Way
he
too many.
He had a lot of sons. He had an illegitimate son. And he had a couple of cousins as well. And
right.
when Alfonso I died, there was a definite power struggle to who was going to take the reins in Asturias.
And by the way, at this moment in Al-Andalus, somebody needs to lean over to the emir and say, see, this is why you don't have 75 kids.
Well, they seem to work it out all right, but
yes.
the reigning family in Asturias did not. Because
no.
we went through Fruela the Cruel, we went
yeah.
through Aurelio, we went through Silo, we went through Morigato,
Things
and we
got
went through
real
Bermudo.
Game of Thronesy. Things got real
it
Game
got
of Thronesy.
Very Game of Thronesy as we mm-hmm. went through basically all of the sons.
Yes.
And then two of the cousins, mm-hmm. we got the illegitimate son as well.
Yes.
We got one guy who married a daughter of Alfonso
yes.
I. Just basically everybody is ruling. And the person who is hanging around in the background is Alfonso mm-hmm. II.
Yes.
He was very young when
yes.
Alfonso I died. He's Alfonso I's grandson,
yep.
right?
Yep.
And he was kind of seen as the person who would be inheriting the throne, but he was just too young.
Every year he gets a new t-shirt, and the t-shirt always says, "Biden my time, Biden my time."
But he did. He bided his time very well, and in the year 791, he becomes king, Alfonso II, and he remains king until 842.
Yeah, boy, did he take over.
2 years.
I mean, insane.
He was very patient, and he got his reward. Now, Alfonso II set up a bunch of amazing things that we still know Asturias for to this day. He moved the capital to Oviedo. He supposedly, while he was king, the bones of St. James were discovered, and
he created the
pilgrimage site,
best tourist trap ever,
set up in Santiago de Compostela, which is in Galicia, which forms part of the Asturian crown. Mm-hmm. He was supposedly the first person to go on this pilgrimage and go to Santiago de Compostela to see the bones. He built a lot of churches. He invested in all kinds of social projects, monasteries. But unfortunately, his nickname was the Chaste.
I was going to say, there was one thing, one project he never got around to.
Now, he was married, I discovered in my research.
Oh, yes, that poor woman.
But apparently, his wife agreed to help him maintain his chastity, and they did not have any children.
I imagine that for her sake, that it was sort of an Eleanor Roosevelt situation where she had a private secretary who was her longtime companion or something like that. Just, I want her to be happy.
I think maybe she probably was. Maybe she wasn't really into it either. And maybe the both of them were like, all right, well, we could be rich and have our own bedrooms.
Sure.
That's not too bad either.
Why not?
Well, the problem is that when Alfonso II dies, there's no obvious heir.
Yeah.
He didn't leave one.
Yeah, that's sort of the same problem they had when Elizabeth I finally kicked the bucket. When you have a virgin monarch.
Yeah, what do you do? Well, what you do is you have to go back to one of those cousins that ruled during the Game of Thrones shuffle, and you take his son, which is Ramiro I.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So Ramiro ruled from 842 to 850, and then Ramiro's son Ordoño ruled from 850 to 866, and they were both acceptable. You
know, medium reigns, nothing.
Medium reigns, not too bad.
But,
But one thing that is going to become more of a pertinent event in our podcast as we go on is the repopulation of the Duero region. So all the way back with Alfonso I, one of the things he did to consolidate power at the beginning of the Asturian reign was he depopulated basically a buffer zone between Asturias and Al-Andalus.
Right.
Basically just went in and told all the people living there, you know what, this is part of our kingdom, but I cannot defend this. Please come and live in the cities further up north.
I was going to say, the term DMZ is not going to mean anything to you guys, but that's what this is.
Yeah, basically.
Literally demilitarized. We are not going to be defending you.
Right. But as the years have gone on, there have been attempts to repopulate the zone. And this really starts to pick up in Ramiro and Ordoño's times. We talked a little bit in their episodes about the repopulation efforts. And we talked about it because in our conquistadores category, we talk about how much land did they conquer. Well, they didn't conquer any land. The boundaries are still the same, but there are more people living in the boundaries closer to the edge. That demilitarized zone is going away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an expansion. I mean, there's people and stuff there that wasn't there before. So
yes. And actually, our next Asturian monarch is Alfonso III, who the Chronicle's named after him. So he is pretty important. His nickname is the Great, by the
way. Well, there you go. That's a tip off. Mind you, if I recall correctly, just because the Chronicle is named after him doesn't mean that he appears in the Chronicle.
He does not appear in the Chronicle because it was written during his lifetime and under his auspices. Actually, it may have even been written under Ordoño's kingship. We're not 100% certain. But it's named after him, but it does not comprise any events from his life because it was written too early for that, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. You know, you don't want to start writing the biography while the subject is still alive because something might happen to change, you know, your necessary approach.
Is that from Don Quixote? Does Don Quixote meet a man who is writing his own autobiography?
Yes.
And he has to keep stopping and redoing it because he keeps living?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that sounds like Cervantes.
Yes, that's very Cervantes.
Well, so that was the problem with Alfonso III. He could not be writing his complete biography because he was alive when the chronicle was written.
Yes.
Unfortunately. And then we also have two other seasons that we're working on for two smaller mm-hmm. kingdoms that are going yes. to become extremely, extremely important coming mm-hmm. up. The first is the County of Barcelona. Now, at this point, we don't have any, for example, kings here. What we have is similar to what we had in the governor's period, where the people who are in charge in the County of Barcelona are subject to the King of the Franks.
Right, exactly.
However, I find it interesting to go through their history, not only because mm-hmm. a lot of interesting things did happen, but much like the governorship under the caliphate, the counts of Barcelona oftentimes did not do what the King of the Franks wanted them to do. They were quite independent.
There's a fair amount of make me in the relations between these two areas.
Yes. So far we've talked about three counts of mm-hmm. Barcelona. First, we had Berra. Yes. Berra was the first count of Barcelona, and he was one of the generals that took Barcelona from mm-hmm. Al-Andalus, right? So it had been under Muslim control. He was part of the army that sacked it. I mean, not completely sacked it, but that took it from Al-Andalus and then became the governor of the region.
Although, how hilarious would it be if he had completely sacked and razed the city and then became notified that he was going to have to rule it?
He's standing on the smoldering embers and looking around like, oops. Well,
on the one hand, it's going to be real easy. On the other hand, this is going to suck.
Yeah. So he was Count of Barcelona from 801 to 820.
Mm-hmm.
He was followed by Rampo, who was just six years in the position. Not too much to say about him.
No. Mm-hmm.
And then we had Bernard.
Bernard I.
Bernard of Septimania.
Yes.
He was quite the character. He was actually counted two times. He was count from 826 to 832, and then he was count from 836 to 844.
Yeah. So he just sit in a corner for a long time.
Well, basically what happened is he rose in esteem so quickly from being the Count of Barcelona and the Margrave of Septimania, or the Count of Septimania as well, mm-hmm. which is why he's called Bernard of Septimania, that he actually got appointed to a position at court.
Yeah, right? But...
He didn't play court politics very well.
No, he was really bad at it.
He eventually got kicked out thanks to rumors that he was sleeping with the queen.
And again, it is an indication of either just how charming he was vis-a-vis the king, or just how weak the king was that he lived.
Well, I don't know that the king believed the rumors, I suppose.
Right.
But he couldn't do much more than just say, okay, Bernard, you can escape in the middle of the night.
Right.
He couldn't protect him.
Right. Others, a sufficient number of others believed it that he had to skedaddle.
He did. And then he spent 3 years not being the Count of Barcelona.
Yes.
But he remained in Septimania, which was always mm-hmm. a thorn in the side of the Count of Barcelona, who was Berenguer at the time. Mm-hmm. Eventually, there was a council called to kind of sort this out because Bernard of Septimania had so much power in the region and Berenguer was unable to fully control his territory that they said, okay, mm-hmm. just both of you come here. Mm-hmm. We'll talk it out. We'll figure out what's going on. They both said okay. And then mm-hmm. Berenguer died on the way to the meeting.
That's right.
So Bernard got the countyship back by default.
Yeah, I mean... Look, if you're not going to take it, you're not going to... Oh, you're not... Okay.
I mean, they didn't have anyone else. They were trying to decide between two counts of Barcelona, and then they only had one count of Barcelona.
Yep.
Whoops. So then Bernard was Count of Barcelona for the second time from 836 to 844. Made a real hash of it that time. Was extremely unpopular.
Wasn't good at it.
and eventually was executed on orders of the King of the Franks, Charles the Bald. Yep. Finally. So we're probably going to go through a bunch more counts of Barcelona so we can catch up to the other two kingdoms. Because right now in Cordoba, we are at the year 886.
Okay.
In Asturias, we're at the year 866, but Alfonso the Great is going to be very long. So I want to do him.
He is going to hang around for a minute.
He's going to hang around for a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. But in the Count of Barcelona, Bernard I was executed in 844. So we've got like 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 more to do. Like we'll probably get through them pretty quickly because they're all pretty short. Yeah, unfortunately.
That doesn't speak well of the desirability of the position.
No, it's not going to be really great for a while. I'm sure we're not going to give out very many fueros in this run of Counts of Barcelona. But the good thing is, when we end with this run of the Counts of Barcelona in 78, not only will we be caught up with the Emirate of Cordoba, the next one is going to be Wilfred the Hairy.
Yay!
So we're there, finally. All right. Wilfred the Hairy.
Can't wait.
So that's the first other kingdom that we started discussing was the County of Barcelona. And the other one was the Kingdom of Navarre, which is kind of overstating it. At this point, it's really just the King of Pamplona. But we talked about Íñigo Arista. He is the very first power broker in the area. So Navarre is kind of an interesting area. It's kind of in the northeast of Spain, and it was basically a buffer state between Al-Andalus and the Franks. And back in time immemorial, when Musa conquered the peninsula, the ruling family in the area was the family of Count Cassius. You remember him? So Count Cassius was a Visigoth who converted to Islam, him and his whole family. You might remember that his oldest son was named Fortun. And then all of his other sons were named like Muhammad, Ali, Abdulaziz.
So it made it real easy to identify when the conversion happened.
So the conversion clearly happened when Fortun was a child. And then, of course, Cassius and his wife went on and had many other children. But this family became the Banu Qasi. Qasi is thought to be a corruption of Cassius. And you'll see these names Fortun recycled. And as a matter of fact, one of the children of Count Cassius, a sister of Fortun, ended up marrying Musa's son. So you will see Musa kind of cycle through these important names as well. Because that's now part of the family. So with this important connection and with their strategic area, the Banu Qasi became very, 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 very powerful. And at the time when Íñigo Arista becomes king of Pamplona, he also has a connection to the Banu Qasi because his half-sibling is Musa ibn Musa. So Musa ibn Musa will become the head of the Banu Qasi. At the time when Íñigo Arista first starts, it's his father who is Musa ibn Fortun. Not that Fortun, it's been a couple generations of Fortunes. So this is a Basque area.
Íñigo is
kind of a telltale there. Íñigo is not really a super Spanish name.
No.
Or a super Visigothic name, I suppose. So according to tradition, he was elected king of Pamplona in 824. However, really, there's some debate as to whether he was subject to Cordoba or not. The biggest breaking point happened when he and Musa ibn Musa joined forces to rebel against Cordoba.
All right.
This was in 841. So they get together. They decide, you know what? We want to be in charge of this area. Technically, we're subject to Cordoba, to Al-Andalus.
We want
an independent kingdom of Pamplona and the Banu Qasi. It worked okay. Musa eventually was forced to submit, but Íñigo, I mean, the problem with Íñigo is that he died in 851, it was really left unsettled as to what the situation of Pamplona was going to be in relation to Cordoba, We kind of left it there. So the next place we're going to go with the Kingdom of Pamplona, the Kingdom of Navarre, is going to Íñigo Arista's son. This guy is named García Iñiguez. So you can see that the surnames at this point are still basically patronymics. So Iñiguez, the son of Íñigo. García Iñiguez is going to be really interesting, and he rules for quite some time as well, 851 to 882.
Right.
So probably what we're going to do is we're going to do a bunch of the the Counts of Barcelona. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Then we're going to come back and do Garcia Iñiguez.
Okay.
That'll catch us all up to about the 880s.
Okay.
And then we can proceed with Asturias and with the Emirate of Cordoba.
Okay.
We're kind of getting to the end. I mean, I don't want to say the end, but we're getting to some changing times in both of those, right? Right. The Asturian monarchs, we have Alfonso III, and then we have Fruela II.
Right.
And then we're going to change to a different dynasty.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So we only got two more for the Asturian monarchs. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
And for the Emirate of Cordoba, we have three more. We have Al-Mudir, we have Abdallah ibn Muhammad, and we have Abdalrahman III. And then in the middle of Abdalrahman III's reign, the constitution of Al-Andalus as a political entity will change.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's going to be big changes coming up in both of those.
Yeah.
And we don't have very, very long before we get there, but we got to catch up with the County of Barcelona. We got to catch up with the Kingdom of Navarre first. Mm-hmm. So that is what we will be recording next. That was our little summary of where we've been in the Spanish Armada.
And I think it made it clear why we needed to take a break.
It's getting complicated, and Castilla is coming up too. The County of Castile
is
going to come up eventually, not for another like 100 years or so, but we're going to have another set of players in the mix.
Right.
Yeah. So next time you hear from us, we will be talking about some Frankish counts and getting to know what's going on in Barcelona.
Goody.
We look forward to you listening to our next episode.
Yes.
See you later.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.